When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
From The Nation magazine, this is Start Making Sense. Political talk without the boring parts. I'm John Wiener. Today we'll talk about Jared Kushner's new job on the White House Coronavirus Task Force. Amy Willens will report. She's our chief Jared correspondent. Also, Nation columnist Layla Lalami will talk about her novel, The Other Americans. It's about the suspicious death of a Moroccan immigrant in a small town in California. It's a family saga, a murder mystery, and a love story. And it's out now in paperback. But first, the Pentagon and the virus. Donald Trump kept saying for weeks that the COVID-19 epidemic, quote, something that just surprised the whole world, something that, quote, came out of nowhere. Of course, we now know there were many warning signs, but The Nation's Ken Klippenstein is reporting an especially significant discovery. The military knew, not just in December or January, but years ago, that a coronavirus was coming. He's Washington correspondent for the magazine. Ken Klippenstein, welcome to the program.
Hey, great to be on.
Well, two big questions. What did the Pentagon know, and when did they know it?
So according to this document that was leaked to me, dated January 6th of 2017, U.S. NORTHCOM, which stands for Northern Command, this is the part of the military that has oversight of North America, that's what NORTHCOM stands for, anticipated, I'm going to quote from it now, quote, the most likely and significant threat is a novel respiratory disease, particularly a novel influenza disease. An outbreak in a single community can quickly evolve into a multinational health crisis that causes millions to suffer, as well as spark major disruption in every facet of society. And it goes on to anticipate a number of problems that ended up, in fact, emerging. For example, lack of mechanical ventilators, lack of face masks, lack of equipment generally, lack of supply chains to be able to distribute them, and subsequent brutal competition in the private sector over a lot of these resources, which I think proved uncannily accurate.
And was this a secret document, a classified document? How come we haven't seen it before you published it?
It's kind of a gray area between classified and unclassified. So technically it's unclassified, but it's what's called for official use only. That is an internal designation. It is a designation that the government uses for certain internal documents like law enforcement documents, military documents, to make it so that it's not something that's disseminated to the public. And even when, you know, reporters request it under Freedom of Information Act, that it has certain protections against portions of it being released. So while it's not classified, it was something that they did not want released to the public.
Trump did nothing, even though this document was created in 2017. Are you sure he got the report? Where did it go from the people who wrote it?
So when you have the headquarters of NORTHCOM producing something like this, as the document shows, it's a very high level military document. And that's a region that's obviously important because this is North America. That's where the, you know, contiguous United States is. I find it very hard to believe that this wasn't disseminated to the White House. But what we know is that the White House, in what are called presidential daily briefs, each day the president is briefed by leaders of the intelligence community about threats to the United States and its interests. And what we do know is that the president had been briefed multiple times not just about coronavirus earlier this year, but about the threat of pandemics for years and years now. An individual I spoke to in the Defense Intelligence Agency, his name is Dennis Kaufman, described how they had known and kept their eye on coronavirus for a very long time, for at least a decade prior to this. So this is something that was well known, and indeed they have more intelligence than what we are able to ascertain. What we're seeing is the tip of the iceberg. When we see, for example, this document, or there's something called the Global Threat Assessment, if I remember correctly, another thing that the intelligence community brings to the president and to the other policymakers, that describes the threat of these pandemics, that none of that is including. So, for example, this document has a number of classified annexes that it refers to. We did not publish classified annexes, nor do I, nor am I in possession of them, because they're very tightly guarded. And so those annexes are going to go they're going to go into even further detail than what we're seeing. And so what we're seeing is really just the tip of the iceberg about what the administration knew.
And why would any of this be classified, I wonder? I mean, the coronavirus is a threat to everybody, and the more we know about it, the better off we're likely to be in resisting it.
There's certainly overclassification and, you know, problems with how aggressively administrations classify things. If you look at annual reports that are put out to give you a sense of how many classified documents are produced, it has just ballooned over the last couple decades. So unless the secrets are increasing, it would seem that they're abusing that part.
Yes.
However, when you look at something like China, I think there are probably certain cases where what the intelligence community calls sources and methods, they want to
yes.
be able to protect those. So, for example, if the CIA has an asset in China that is giving us information about what their internal government's response to the health system is, you want to be able to obscure the information such that that individual's identity remains concealed, so they don't get killed, or so that we don't lose access. So, for example, if they're doing what are called, and we have very sophisticated apparatus looking at what are called bio threats, pandemics, diseases, both manufactured and organic. And so we use things like human intelligence, running spies, signals intelligence. You know, we hack into computer systems, our military does, and our intelligence agencies do. And so that would be their argument for why they can't disclose these things, is because disclosing them would reveal some of these operations, and we would lose insight. There's certainly some truth to that, but there's plenty of evidence that they also abuse these privileges as well, in terms of not letting us know.
So you're saying the Pentagon has been concerned about coronaviruses as part of the threats to the security of the United States. Are they talking here about a bioweapon? Are they suggesting that the coronavirus would be used intentionally against American military forces? There is that conspiracy theory from Tom Cotton, the senator from Arkansas, who says, you know, the coronavirus is a bioweapon created by the Chinese government that escaped from a secret lab in Wuhan. And there are people in the Twitterverse who say, yeah, it wasn't an accident. It's an intentional attack by China on us and the world. Is that what the Pentagon report is suggesting here?
No, I've spoken to, not only is the Pentagon report not suggesting that, that's also not what anyone that I've spoken to in the military intelligence community is saying. That is widely regarded as sort of a crackpot idea. Very self-serving, though, because when the president can go and say, China, 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 you know, call it the Wuhan virus, call it the China virus, that, you know, politically is getting some of the heat off themselves and saying it's actually their fault. It's not my fault that, you know, I waited since knowing about this since at least January, perhaps sooner than that even, and didn't do anything. It's actually the baleful Chinese that hoisted this on us, and we should all be angry at them instead of myself. So I've been sort of amazed at the uniformity of opinion in terms of people I've spoken to, both inside and outside government, who've said, no, this is clearly not something that was manufactured. At worst, it was an accident, if even that, on the part of the Chinese government. But I've seen no indication or evidence to suggest that there was any sort of intention behind it.
An accident? You mean that it was being developed as a bioweapon, but it escaped from the lab? Is that part of this report?
Not necessarily that. That's not in the report, but this is with intelligence officials I've spoken to who know about this stuff and are in touch with people that know about it. And they've said that it could have been something where they themselves were trying to, just in a laboratory setting, like we would have researching a disease and trying to find a cure for it.
And just to go back a step here, when we get big leaks like this one, of course we ask, what's the motivation of the leaker? You kind of referred to this in passing, but let's be specific. What do you think is going on here? Why is the Pentagon sharing this material, someone in the Pentagon sharing this with you now?
Well, I want to stress that this source wanted to tell me that they didn't have anything derogatory to say about the military and that and the intelligence community, and that they thought they had done their jobs as well as they could have, and that they knew what was going on. They were just not listened to. And that seemed to me to be very clearly the motive, is to correct the public record around this narrative that's coalescing that, oh, this is just like, you know, this is another intelligence failure like 9/11 where the CIA just got it wrong, or, you know, the intelligence agencies got it wrong. No, they didn't get it wrong. They had it right. It was the policymakers that got it wrong and didn't listen.
So this is evidence not only of Trump's monumental incompetence, but in some ways equally significant, the military's efforts to challenge him, to expose him, to criticize him for it. Or am I going too far?
No, I believe so, absolutely. And I've spoken, when I do a story like this, you know, I'll mention one source is providing something for me, but these are very often group endeavors where, you know, people introduce me to other people, different people look at things for me and tell me if this looks right, you know, does it pass the smell test, so on and so forth. And the impression I get from so many military and intelligence is that they are furious at the way that this is being handled. And many of these, I want to, you know, stress, are not necessarily progressive nation readers. You know, many of them, their politics might surprise you. And they're angry because the military has something called readiness that they're always very concerned about. And readiness is the notion that, you know, should some sort of, you know, threat emerge, the need to send a bunch of troops somewhere, they are ready and prepared and, you know, healthy and able to do that. And so on an institutional level, that's a big concern because this document describes in pretty shocking detail what it anticipates to be a loss of huge numbers of personnel. And I actually had a document leaked to me from the Department of Homeland Security that found the same thing, that they're talking, you know, losing so many personnel that they're not able to maintain the functions of civil society. So we're talking, you know, breakdown in law and order. So very chilling stuff that I really don't think is exaggerated. It makes sense if you look at what could happen. So that's a lot of the concern on their part. And then also just personally, like I was talking to a Marine recently. He was very angry about the fact that they had not relaxed what are called the grooming standards. So when you see, you know, Marines that have very short hair cropped a certain way, that's part of the rules, you know. And so other branches within the military have said, okay, you don't have to go get haircuts anymore because when you go to a barber, you're not social distancing, and that's a risk we don't necessarily need to take right now. You know, it's fine if you want to grow your hair out for the time being. And for whatever reason, the Marines have not relaxed that standard. This person was very angry, and that is exactly the sort of tone and tenor of things I'm hearing from many tipsters reaching out who often, you know, won't talk to the media. They're saying, you know, we're going to die. My friends are going to die, could die, if this thing is not taken seriously enough because the politicals at the top are not responding with adequate urgency.
Ken Klippenstein, the nation's Washington correspondent. You can read his piece and see the Pentagon documents at thenation.com. Ken, thank you for this terrific report.
Great to talk to you.
Now it's time for the Jared Report. For that, we turn to our chief Jared correspondent, Amy Willens. She is a longtime contributing editor at The Nation, and she was also a Jerusalem correspondent for The New Yorker. And she's best known, of course, for her work on Haiti, most recently the award-winning book Farewell, Fred Voodoo. Amy, welcome back.
Thank you, John. So nice to be here.
Well, last Thursday was when Jared spoke at the president's daily coronavirus briefing for the press, and Vice President Pence introduced them by saying Jared had been directed by the White House Coronavirus Task Force to take on a central role in the administration's response to the pandemic. This was big news. What are his responsibilities?
He's running the supply chain for emergency protective equipment. He's in charge of ventilators. He's in charge of distributing or not distributing the federal stockpile of medical supplies. He's fielding questions and I wouldn't call them demands, but requests from governors around the country. Those are among his tasks.
And this is a special post that's been created for him inside FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Remind us about Jared's qualifications for this job.
Well, top qualification is he married Ivanka Trump. That's the daughter of the president, in case you've forgotten. Okay. So that's a major qualification. Then my first encounter with Jared Kushner was when he came to the New York Observer newspaper and ran that into the ground. Then he bought a skyscraper in New York for something like $1.8 billion, more than had ever been spent on a property in New York. And it went into bankruptcy. I don't know that he's ever dealt with a disease of any kind.
Okay.
No, he has no qualifications for this job, but that doesn't stop Trump. He didn't have any qualifications for any of the other jobs Trump has given him, other than being the first son-in-law. So, you know, why not put him in charge of a global pandemic that is now sweeping across the country and he has no idea what to do?
He spoke at that press briefing and remind us what he said.
He said the notion of a federal stockpile of medical equipment was it's supposed to be our stockpile. It's not supposed to be state stockpiles that they can then use. That's what he said.
And our stockpile, that's a very strange.
Yeah, who's us? No one really knows who the our is. But I looked into this a little bit. And on the federal stockpile's homepage that morning before Jared spoke, it said, Strategic National Stockpile is the nation's largest supply of life-saving pharmaceuticals and medical supplies for use in a public health emergency severe enough to cause local supplies to run out. When state, local, tribal, and territorial responders request federal assistance to support their response efforts, the stockpile ensures that the right medicines and supplies get to those who need them most during an emergency.
Sounds great.
The day after Jared spoke about how the stockpile was ours and for us and not for the states, the sentences on the Strategic National Stockpile page was gone. And the revised page reads, the Strategic National Stockpile's role is to supplement state and local supplies during public health emergencies. Many states have products stockpiled as well. The supplies, medicines, and devices for life-saving care contained in the stockpile can be used as a short-term stopgap buffer when the immediate supply of adequate amounts of these materials may not be immediately available. As someone said, this was Jeremy Corndyke, who served under Obama as director of the U.S. AIDS Office of U.S. Foreign Disaster Assistance. He said that the original copy couldn't be a more literal refutation of Jared's claim, and he called the change absolutely Orwellian. It is, of course. And the amazing thing is Jared has gone on to say that the governor's demands for help from the federal government are not based on anything real, and that Jared knows about each state's stockpile, and that Governor Cuomo has lots of stockpiles of medical equipment in New York and doesn't need help from the federal government, all based on nothing.
Usually the job of the White House is to say, we're all in this together. We're doing everything that we can to help everybody so everybody can be healthy. Jared is sort of taking the opposite tack of blaming governors, especially Democratic governors, for failing to do their job, and therefore it's not his fault. That doesn't seem like the ideal leadership role in a time of crisis.
No, but it's perfect for a member of this family, and especially for Jared Kushner, who is not a responsibility taker. You know, one of the many qualifications he brought to this was the fact that he did not make peace in the Middle East, which was another of the insoluble problems. That's what President Trump likes to do to Jared. He gives him all the insoluble problems, even though the guy's incompetent. So he gave him the opioid crisis to solve. That's not solved. He gave him peace in the Middle East to make. He didn't make peace in the Middle East. He asked him to reform government. We see where that's gone. And he's also running the Trump campaign for 2020, by the way. Yeah, and a lot of people have been speculating. Well, what exactly? I mean, what if he's running the coronavirus challenged in order to, you know, make hay for the presidential campaign? I think he's not doing that good a job, but you know, you never know with Trump supporters what they're going to think of a job that I might think is not being done well. They might think it's being done really well. Like, yeah, they might think, screw California and New York. Let's keep that federal stockpile for us.
Well, to shift the focus slightly, let's talk about his brother. This is Josh Kushner, Some call him the good Kushner. He's also been in the news lately for developing a website to help Americans find coronavirus testing sites. Isn't that a great thing for the good Kushner, Brother Josh, to be doing?
It was a brilliant idea. They wanted to have a website where you could go on and it would direct you to the nearest coronavirus testing site in your neighborhood or maybe a couple of neighborhoods down, and you could do drive-through testing, et cetera. And Jared had owned part of this group called Oscar Health, which was developing the website. But strangely, the website never really materialized. It was suddenly scrapped. The Atlantic did a big takeout on it, and it never saw the light of day. And what to me was most interesting about it was a website directing you to testing, but there is no testing. So there's just, I think the United States has the least tested population per capita of any developed nation. So this was a website in theory, and Josh Kushner had his father-in-law go online to a group of doctors his father-in-law knew to ask them for recommendations about it, and it all fell apart, you know, and it was all nepotism anyway.
And is this a nonprofit organization, Oscar Health?
No, Oscar Health is a health insurance company.
Why would a private insurance company be given the responsibility to develop the government website directing Americans to coronavirus testing places?
Wait, are you leading the witness? I can't answer that question. But you know what I find amazing also?
What?
It is just shocking to me that in the United States, which I formerly thought of as a kind of a great country with a booming economy, it may not be my favorite country in the world. It may not have the economy, the style of which I like the best, but I thought it was a fairly vibrant economy. And instead of making our own masks and our own ventilators and our own protective equipment, we are brilliantly, the Trump administration is patting itself on the back for flying in equipment from China. It's stunning to me that the War Powers Act has not been, or whatever it's called now, the defense production maybe, is not being used appropriately to, one, put Americans back to business again, and two, to make things to fight this virus and to help people on the front lines, really soldiers on the front lines, to protect themselves as they go into war against a serious enemy. And we're not doing that ourselves. We're having plane loads come in from China. Is that Trumpian or is that not Trumpian? I'm not sure.
And finally, it's time for Ivanka Watch reporting on the first daughter. Ivanka was exposed to the virus early on during a meeting with an infected Australian official, so she self-quarantined. She did not get sick. What's she been doing since?
First of all, why was Ivanka Trump meeting with an Australian official? It beggars the imagination, but okay. So, well, she's working really hard to help Americans from her multi-million-dollar home in a very beautiful area of Washington. And she's launched this thing called the hashtag Together Apart campaign. And its motto is to consistently encourage social distancing while maintaining a sense of togetherness online. And they say at the White House, the hashtag can be used to share all types of content, like educational, musical, fitness, or family activity ideas, to entertain our children and each other during social distancing. It doesn't take into account people who don't have jobs or money and can't stay home with their kids and have to figure out, can they get a job doing landscaping in Ivanka's garden so that they can feed their children? No, that is not what it does. But she's working really hard in her own way, although I thought she was responsible in the White House for women's economic needs and problems. But apparently she's not working from home anymore on that particular issue. She's got things more like plan a living room camp out on her Instagram feed. And even more introspective thoughts on like what this weird moment means to Ivanka Trump. It's a unique chance for reflection, self-improvement, and family connectivity. It's almost like a rap session for her or a yoga meet. You know, she's found the time to expand her own mind. We should all be very scared. Yeah, she goes on. She says, so this is how she expands her own mind. Maybe we don't need to be frightened. I've got a Coursera free course going in Greek and Roman mythology. So I'm rereading the Odyssey. Note that, rereading.
Of course.
And I've started to play the guitar, and I'm really working on it. You know what I like about that? You
what?
Can look forward to videos of Ivanka playing, you know, the answer my friend is blowing in the wind on her guitar online. I'm waiting for that moment. Maybe she'll learn to play the dulcimer like Joni Mitchell.
Ivanka is reading the Odyssey and playing the guitar, an excellent example for all of us. Amy Willens is our chief Jared correspondent. Amy, thank you for today's report.
Thanks, John.
Now it's time to talk about The Other Americans. That's the new novel by Leila Lalami. Her last novel, The Moor's Account, won the American Book Award and was a Pulitzer finalist. She's written for The New York Times, The Washington Post, Harper's, and The Guardian. And, of course, she's a columnist for The Nation. Leila Lalami, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Well, America is a country of immigrants, we all say. And the standard immigrant story is the American dream. Immigrant crosses the ocean, works really hard, becomes a success. The story in your new novel is a little more complicated.
As life tends to be. So the book begins with the death of a Moroccan immigrant on a desert road in a hit-and-run accident. And we don't know. There's a mystery about who's driving or whether it's an accident or something else. And the guy who is killed is a Moroccan immigrant. His name is Driss Kerraoui, and he came to the United States in 1981 with his wife following some political trouble he got into in Morocco. And he moves to the desert in the Mojave, starts a business. And the whole idea for him was that he would come to this country with his wife and find safety and opportunity. And the first paragraph of the book is basically this accident where he dies. So the thing that he was searching for, he doesn't find. And then, so the book is told from the perspectives of multiple characters, including his daughter, who's a musician, who returns home at the beginning of the book because of this death, his wife, who's now his widow, his other daughter, the person who runs the business next door, you know, the detective who's investigating the story. But basically, all of these characters have some kind of a connection to him, and the book is told from their perspectives.
And the setting is not a big city immigrant neighborhood like East LA or the Bronx. Instead, you set it in a small town in the Mojave Desert. Already we are surprised.
Well, I think, you know, that sort of is the expectation. I mean, I was born and raised in Rabat, which is the capital of Morocco, and then I lived in London, and after that I lived in Los Angeles. So I've always thought of myself as a big city person. It's a space that I feel comfortable in, the density, the noise, and all of that, and the mix of people. But in writing this book, I had two reasons for setting it in the desert. One was just because I like the desert.
That's
and
a good
reason. Yes. And I, you know, a few years ago, we started going out to the Mojave, actually. And I just really fell in love with the landscape and with the silence and the peace and the quiet and the sort of the fauna and the flora. And I also like the fact that it's the landscape that requires your attention. It's not something that reveals itself if you're kind of a careless onlooker. It requires you to pay attention in order to notice the life that is happening there. And the second reason is because it starts with this hit and run, I thought it would be much more interesting to set it in a small town where the people who lost this man, his family members, might at some point come across the perpetrator of this crime.
I guess we have to talk about Donald Trump and the politics of immigration. Of course, he's made a big point about not wanting refugees from those whole countries. He prefers blonde and blue-eyed immigrants from Norway, he said. In your book, that issue, the politics of immigration, is often in the background and certainly in our minds as readers.
Yeah. I was wondering how long it was going to take us to before we got to Trump. You know, I have a theory that no conversation between any people in this country can last for long without Donald Trump coming up.
We went 4 minutes.
Yes, that's that. So it is a question that has come up as I've been promoting this book. But I started working on this book in 2014, long before Trump announced, and frankly, but long before I even knew of his prominence. I mean, I honestly knew nothing about the man other than he was a real estate billionaire and that he had a TV show that I'd never watched. So I didn't really know anything about him, and I was working on this story about this immigrant. I've had a long-standing interest in the subject, also because I'm an immigrant myself, and I wanted to write a story about that sort of centers on this immigrant. The book basically explores immigration from multiple different perspectives. There's the couple who came here in 1981, but there's also one daughter who was brought here as a toddler, and then one daughter who was born here. And it basically goes into their different experiences of immigration. One, even though she's born here, she still has the effects of that immigration are still felt upon her. And then there's another character who's an undocumented immigrant. So that's a completely different situation for him and sort of the choices that he faces.
Let's talk about the cop a little bit. This is not just an immigrant novel. It's also a detective story, mm-hmm. a mystery. Mm-hmm. And mysteries are a well-established genre with their own, you know, requirements and traditions. It's kind of a bold thing to step across the line into that territory. How hard was it for you to write about the cops and the detectives? Did you study Michael Connelly's books? Did you do, I don't know, ride-alongs with cops in the desert?
We have a saying in Morocco that goes something like this. He who has a tongue will never be lost, which the idea being that as long as you ask questions, you will get answers. So I knew, you know, in working on this story, once I wanted to include an element of mystery, that I had to basically do my homework. Fortunately, I'd grown up, when I was young, like when I was in my teens, that's all I read was mysteries. So I actually was pretty well read from that, but I hadn't picked up a mystery in quite some time. So I wrote my friend Todd Goldberg, who's a crime writer, and I said, Todd, help me out, you know, give me a nice long reading list of what do you admire, what's going on. And so he gave me this long list, and I went home and I read and read and read all these crime writers. And then I also did my own research. So as you mentioned, I went on a ride along with a sheriff's deputy from the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department.
Tell us about the ride along. What was that like?
It was 12 hours and it was in the heat. And his name was Officer Campos. He was very nice. And we had all kinds of encounters during the day. And of course, I had to remain in my seat and obey all of his directives. But I got to see a lot. I got to see, you know, like arrests and things like that he had to do that day. But what I came away with, honestly, was how much law enforcement is being used basically as like social work. Like, for example, one time we stopped because the neighbors had called the police because they were worried about this woman who they thought was feeling suicidal because she had lost her daughter. And so he had to come and basically pick her up and potentially take her for a psychiatric hold. And so it was like this whole, and you know, that's obviously something that I would imagine a social worker would be involved in, but instead it was the cops being called. I also researched the logistics of a hit and run because I was very naive when I started working on this book. I thought, you know, this guy is going to die in a hit and run. The car comes out, hits him, he dies, right? It shouldn't be complicated. But of course, it's complicated because what kind of a car, what kind of a collision would result in a fatality, what clues might be left, all kinds of things have to be sorted out. And I got really lucky because a friend of mine connected me with someone who's a scientist and who basically serves as an expert witness on these sort of hit and run trials. So I basically did a lot of homework is what I'm trying to say in order to write the mystery.
I want to ask about your column for The Nation.
Yes.
You started writing it 3 years ago. That was before the election when we all thought Hillary would win. And so you would be you know, a Muslim immigrant columnist at America's Oldest Weekly with a Democratic first woman president of America. And then after November 2016, you had a big new task. You were the immigrant Muslim columnist while Trump was the anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant president. I doubt that was the job you thought you were going to take on.
Well, I mean, I certainly, like many other people, thought that Clinton would win. But having said that, I do think that it's not just simply a question of anti-immigrant, but just like immigrant, because I don't necessarily think that Hillary Clinton's approach was a progressive approach on immigration. So if you look, for example, at what made Trump stand out from among his fellow Republican hopefuls, it was the immigration ban on Muslims, but it was also building the wall, right? So, but the wall didn't, the wall was there. It wasn't something that started with Trump. It started with Clinton. I mean, Clinton started building the first wall. It was in San Diego and Tijuana. It was 13 miles of fencing. And the George W. Bush administration expanded that to another 700 miles. And then those fences and walls were built during the Bush administration and the Obama administration. So what I'm trying to say is there is a sense of continuity between both Democratic and Republican administrations on immigration. And while Trump's rhetoric is just hateful and repugnant, we have to recognize that continuity. And when we talk about immigration, it's not a question of like Trump is bad and Clinton is good, but more of like how this immigration policy that has been going on for more than 25 years, how has it helped the country? Has it helped the country? Has it hurt the country? And what exactly are its effects on people?
You and I live on the west side of Los Angeles. You live in Santa Monica. This is the most, you know, liberal, democratic, anti-Trump place in America, pretty much. There's only one precinct in all of L.A. County where Trump won. It was in Beverly Hills. But I wonder, you are an immigrant from Morocco. You're an American citizen. You're a Muslim. Do you worry about your safety?
Well, I feel duty-bound to remind listeners that Santa Monica, however liberal it may be, produced Stephen Miller, who went to the high school some years ago that my child now attends. So, you know, I think, again, this idea that it's everything, like that it's either or, like we really do have to question that. And just yesterday, the Washington Post revealed that Stephen Miller had been counseling the president to, you know, basically stage these highly public, highly visible mass arrests of immigrants and their families and their kids in their homes. And the only reason they haven't done it, because they've been working on it for a year, the only reason it hasn't happened yet is because Kirsten Nielsen said, well, I don't have enough, the logistics of it, I don't have enough beds, and I don't know what to do with the paperwork because some of them have U.S. citizens. What do I do? And so it was because of that she was forced out. And as far as like living in Santa Monica, this goes back to what I'm saying. You know, it's, yes, I feel safe on a day-to-day basis in my community. But I never let myself feel too safe because I know, based on the example of Stephen Miller, that there is this racist next door, that there is this white nationalist who could be living next door. And I mean, just yesterday when I was on Twitter and I linked to this Washington Post story, all factual, you know, I wasn't even editorializing or saying what I thought. I just said what the headline was basically saying. And some rando on Twitter says, do you have your green card? To me, I mean, and this is something that happens all the time, like go back to your country and things like that. So I guess what I'm trying to say is I never allow myself to kind of forget about that, of that virulently anti-immigration strain that is part and parcel of American history.
Well, now it's time for your Minnesota moment. That's news from my hometown of St. Paul that you won't get from Sarah Huckabee Sanders. You just got back from a book festival in Minneapolis.
I did.
And Minnesota has the highest proportion of immigrants and refugees of any state. I looked up where they're from. Number one source of immigrants to Minnesota is Mexicans. Second, people from India. Third, Somalis like Ilhan Omar. Mm-hmm. Fourth, Hmong from Laos. And lots of them, of course, are refugees. What was your book event in Minneapolis like? Did any of this come up there?
Oh, how interesting that you asked me that question, because while I was there, I had to do an interview, and the person who interviewed me is Moroccan. And the first thing she said to me, because it was her first time in Minnesota, she said, I don't understand. Like, this is supposed to be a melting pot. People are supposed to be mixed, but they don't mix. Like, everybody's in their own little, you know, area. But the event was fabulous. It was very well attended, and the conversation was really great. So it was a conversation with Tommy Orange, who did a book called There, There, and it was moderated by Joseph Farag.
Last question, the idea of the immigrant writer, you know, it's such a generic term. On the other hand, the idea of the immigrant is so central to our politics and our culture today. Do you want to be called an immigrant writer?
I want to be called a good writer.
Yes.
That's what I want to be called. And if you want to add anything else beyond that, as long as you put good in there, then that's what matters to me.
Leila Lalami, her wonderful new novel is The Other Americans. Leila, thanks so much for
talking
to us.
Thank you very much for having me.
We spoke with Leila last May. Her book was published in paperback this week. Start Making Sense, a podcast from The Nation magazine, is co-produced by the LA Review of Books and recorded in Los Angeles at our Blythe Avenue studios. Our audio engineer is William Broughton. Alan Minsky is our senior producer. Frank Reynolds is our executive producer. Annie Shields is The Nation's engagement editor. D.D. Guttenplan is editor of The Nation. Katrina Vandenhoevel is publisher and editorial director of The Nation. Our theme music is from Barcelona Afrobeat, licensed by Creative Commons. For more principled, progressive journalism from The Nation, you can subscribe online to our print and digital magazine at thenation.com/podcast subscribe with this special discount for Start Making Sense listeners. You can get digital access to all our articles for less than $1.50 a month. Or you can have our print magazine delivered to you for just 60 cents an issue. That's at thenation.com/podcast subscribe, one word. You can find out more about Start Making Sense at thenation.com. You can subscribe to Start Making Sense wherever you get your podcasts, at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or Pocket Casts. I'm John Wiener. Tune in to Start Making Sense next week for more political talk without the boring parts.
These days, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make all kinds of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more, right here in the USA. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs in towns and cities across the country. And jobs bring pride. Purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.